Tales of History and Imagination. Hey everyone. Having come off a long three-parter, I decided to mix things up a little with a collection of shorter tales this week. As I'm trying to match the Patreon minisodes to main feed episodes in some way or other, the following has been languishing in reserve for some time. So where to start tonight? Well, I guess Harold Davidson, the vicar of the parish of Stiffkey, or Stookey, is as good a place as any. Before we descend into his rather foolish history, I have to point out a very different side to the man. Age 16, Harold saw a beautiful young lady leap into the Thames on a dark, foggy night. Without a second thought, he leapt into the water, fishing the young lady out. Dripping wet, the two youngsters sat there telling each other their life stories. The young girl had run away from home in Cambridge, and finding herself penniless, and without any other options but to sell her body, she tried to end her sufferings by diving into the river. Her story moved the young man to reach into his pocket and give a young girl money for a hearty meal and a train ride home. This good deed, rightly, filled Harold with pride. And there was a good chance this single act of kindness set the template for the rest of his life, and that the church were way out of order. But people are complex, and others present a far more interesting story. And today, I'm going to try and condense that story into around 1,500 words, so take of the following what you will. Born in 1875, Harold fell in love with the stage as a young boy. As a young man, he found work as a comic actor in London music hall productions. Before his father pressured him into exiting stage left for a role in the Church of England. In 1898, Harold entered Oxford's Exeter College, where he skimmed along the bottom of his class till he bombed out of Exeter. From there he found a place at another school, Grindle's Hall, and graduated from their course in 1903. During his studies and beyond, he looked back to his time slumming it in London with a real sense of nostalgia. This time imbued him with a great empathy for the poor of London, especially their sex workers. And in his new role, he tried to minister to these folk as much as he could, especially the sex workers. By 1906, Harold had married, as Anglican prelates can, and settled into his new role as rector of Stiffkey. On many a weekday, he would travel to London to offer prayer and charity to the sex workers. If he was there to offer them something more, far be it from me to judge the man. With the outbreak of World War I, Harold signed on to do his bit. In October 1915, he became a Navy chaplain and would serve aboard a couple of different ships. He wasn't well liked with the fighting men, and his commanders found him barely fit for the role. But he did serve a role of sorts to the religious on board. One day in 1916, while ashore in Cairo, Harold was arrested in a brothel. He avoided prosecution by stating he was not there for sex, but was searching for a diseased escort who had infected several of his men. He never really clicked with anyone in the Navy till he was posted to the HMS Leviathan in August 1918, towards the end of his time at sea. On returning to civilian life in March 1919, he discovered his wife, Molly, was 6 months pregnant. He'd been in the Northern Atlantic Ocean at the time, so the child couldn't have been his. The likely father was Colonel Ernest Dowdermain, an old school friend of Harold's who'd been staying at the rectory for much of 1918. Harold was heartbroken that his wife and friend had betrayed him so, but nonetheless was determined to be the child's father. But on the other hand, he was furious and needed to get out of Stookey to cool off. He tried to get himself reassigned to Simla, India for a while, but that posting fell through, and Harold realized he'd need to find some other way to deal with his trauma. Well, before the war, he often spent Monday morning through to Saturday night with London's struggling masses, only doing the bare minimum at the rector of Stookey. He'd just have to double down on that mission now and return to London. Every weekend he'd return, do his sermon, and then catch a train ride back. So, he'd mostly keep on doing what he'd always did, only without any sense of guilt over it now. The next big hit to Harold came by way of a businessman named Arthur Gordon. The prostitute's padre, as Harold was now known, had a constantly diminishing savings account. He was paying for lodgings in London and weekly train rides across the country and was spending a lot of money on his ladies. He was approaching up to 200 women a year, every year, and far be it from me to even suggest he was doing something consenting adults should have every right to do anyway. But one way or another, these ladies were expensive. Arthur Gordon promised Harold he could turn his meager savings into a small fortune with his keen business acumen. Harold could continue his work for decades to come, should he choose. Harold gave him money to invest into, well, probably his own back pocket. Arthur Gordon was a con man. Every indication is he took out all the money and ran. Were he the only victim of Gordon's iffy schemes, well, that would be something. But unfortunately, the padre became a vocal advocate for Mr. Gordon. By 1929, Harold was on the verge of bankruptcy and was unable to spend as much time with his ladies as he was busy trying to track down Arthur Gordon. In the meantime, as popular as he was among some of his parishioners, others were trying hard to get Harold defrocked. In 1927, he'd made an enemy of a Major Hammond, after discovering the Major had cleared some land next to the grave of his recently deceased wife. Harold had written the Major an angry letter over the incident, telling him off for such wanton gardening. Hammond's hatred for the rector bubbled over until, on Armistice Day 1930, Harold's train got delayed and he failed to give a service for the fallen soldiers. The Major was deeply offended at the snub and decided the rector must go. Early the following year, the Major made an official complaint to the Bishop of Norwich, who in turn sent out a private investigator, who soon snapped a photograph of a clothed Harold, up close and personal with a naked woman. This and details of a close friendship with a former sex worker were all the church needed to defrock him. Prostitute's padre, Harold Davidson, now a national celebrity, was determined not to go out like that. He was going to fight the Church of England as far through the courts as he could to be reinstated. He was going to fight them through the media, which made him something of an overnight celebrity. But he had no money and no job, and by now he was pretty sure Arthur Gordon hadn't just got called away to care for a sick aunt, but may in fact be a con man. So he returned to showbiz. He took on a barrel act on Blackpool Pier, and from what I can gather, the act consisted of him being in a barrel, and people walking past while exclaiming, "Look, dear, it's that dirty preacher from the Sunday newspapers." He diversified by standing in a refrigerated chamber, or occasionally roasting himself in a glass-fronted oven. In November 1936, he made the news again, after being arrested for harassing two teenage girls at a train station. He was promising them an audition for a West End show. Later in the month, he got into a public stoush with the Archbishop of Canterbury after he crashed a sermon at Westminster with pamphlets protesting his innocence. By 1937, the punters of Blackpool Pier had lost interest in Harry, but an offer came his way, and this is the real reason I'm telling this tale today. Circus master Captain Fred Rye got in touch with the former rector, and I imagine a conversation went along the lines of,
"Harold, I own a circus with a lot of lions. You're a holy man. We could do this bit where you give a speech to the punters outside the cage. And then you climb into the cage for a minute or two. You'll be as safe as houses, mate. We'll have a lion tamer on hand. But can't you picture it? We'll sell it as a modern-day Daniel in the lion's den.
Though cautious, Harold signed up, joining up with the circus in the seaside town of Skegness. On the night of 28th July 1937, Harold entered the lion's den with a bullwhip and instructions to play the Daniel bit to the hilt. That night he cracked the bullwhip, and some say stepped on a lion's tail, and the lion named Freddy knocked the rector over, seized him by the neck, and proceeded to mortally wound the holy man. Harold Davidson is notable for being the only Anglican vicar ever to be mauled to death by a lion at an English circus. Part 2. The Navigators. In October 2023, my homeland did something foolish, electing a far-right government who, among other complaints, feel our history has lost its focus on the white men, once considered great men. If we have in fact lost that focus, it would be a wonderful thing, because we could then talk freely about just how remarkable the Polynesian navigators who first discovered New Zealand were. 6,000 years ago, give or take a few years, the Lapita people, our name for them, not theirs, sailed from Southern Asia. They packed their lives into large canoes and set off into the unknown. 3,000 years ago, having lived in the northern Philippines and then the Bismarck Archipelago for many generations, they ventured into the vast Pacific Ocean. From evidence of the spread of the Kiore, a rodent brought with them, we can track their progress from island to island, starting in Fiji, then on to Samoa and Tonga, where the Polynesian cultures we know today took form. Over time, they discovered what we now call French Polynesia, and then, well, it went everywhere. Hawaii, Rapa Nui, the American continent where they brought back the sweet potato. One legend tells of a man named Hui Tirangiora, who was said sailed to Antarctica in the 7th century. Whether he did or not, an abandoned waka on the sub-Antarctic Enderby Island from around 1400 AD shows it was at least plausible. They even reached a large southern archipelago called Aotearoa, hundreds of years before James Cook, Jean de Saville, Marion Dufresne, or even Dutch explorer Abel Tasman sighted the faraway land. These intrepid adventurers navigated by the stars, following the songs and stories of their ancestors. Master mariners who'd returned from pioneering voyages, with new songs and tales to add. They knew the sea life intimately, and the winds and the currents. The Polynesians invented the catamaran, although they called it by other names. Waka, Va, Vaka, and so forth. Just like the Phoenicians, they knew how to make a triangular sail, and use it to coast by against the wind by tacking back and forth. The Waka were fast, versatile craft. The largest, the intricately carved Waka Tower, were big enough to accommodate 100 oarsmen, to add to its speed and maneuverability. They were also sacred treasures. The carvings, I'm told, represented their ancestors. When a tree was chosen in the forest, the land around the tree was cleared for the coming fall. A tohunga, something akin to a priest or a shaman, spoke to lift the tapu, or restriction, before the tree was felled. In Aotearoa, at least, once Tane, god of the forest, was satiated, work began on crafting a boat. Now, full disclosure, I live in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and I grew up on stories of a man named Kupe. Though a folkloric figure, general consensus is he did actually exist, though experts place his lifetime anywhere between 950 AD and 1180 AD. He was from a family of master mariners, born at a time when Polynesians hopped from island to island with regularity. This was evident in that his mother was from Raiatea, French Polynesia, and his father from Rarotonga. These two islands are 1,000 kilometres apart. His reason for leaving his home, the settlement of Hawaiki Irangi in Tahiti. Well, that's unclear. The legend states a giant octopus ate all the fish, so Kupe pursued the octopus the length of the Pacific until they reached Aotearoa. Given that, a non-mythical famine is a definite possibility. Whatever the reason, Kupe and his followers set off on a 4,200-kilometre journey into parts unknown. After a long journey, the adventurers spotted land. Kupe's wife, Kura Maratini, naming it Aotearoa, a long white cloud, for its appearance on the horizon. The explorers settled near modern-day Wellington. Many years later, Kupe returned to Hawaiki Rangi, and his journey was added to the oral history. Another intrepid explorer named Toi followed in Kupe's footsteps in the mid-12th century. Maori legend tells of 7 waka following in Toi's footsteps soon after, and settling the lands for good. But the truth is more complex. Many waka came and went with numerous tribes of people we now call by the collective name Maori, settling here over a few centuries. The Polynesians sailed back and forth across the Pacific until something, and we don't know what, changed in the 14th century. Perhaps there was a change in maritime conditions, or a sudden lack of push factors. Perhaps the Polynesians decided now was the time to cultivate the garden. When James Cook arrived in the Pacific in 1769, he did indeed find much of the land richly cultivated, proving the Polynesians as handy as farmers as they were as sailors. Part 3. Antoine Lavoisier's final experiment. From Aotearoa, we travel to Paris, France. The date, 8th of May, 1794. This day, a large crowd has gathered on the Place de la Concorde, a public square near the Champs-Élysées, temporarily renamed the Place de la Révolution. Those in attendance were there to feed their bloodlust, as the dreaded guillotine was set up and prepared to make today's entertainers a good head shorter. On the chopping block today, the much-hated tax farmers, who ran the king's tax collection services. Often from the aristocratic class, the fermiers général were detested due to how much money they made, through surcharges and other fees. Many of them employed brutal methods to recoup tax arrears, like sending thugs out to dole out beatings on debtors. So a large vocal crowd this day was hardly surprising. What would have surprised some, however, was the experiment one of the taxmen had planned for the day. Our protagonist is Antoine Laurent de Lavoisier, tax collector, aristocrat, philanthropist, and father of modern chemistry. As a pioneering scientist, Lavoisier played an important role in a wide range of discoveries, including working out the properties of several elements. This work set the stage for the periodic table. He played a role in the development of the metric system and dismissed once and for all the phlogiston theory that all matter contained a flammable element called phlogiston. Lavoisier was a loud advocate for a better world. He called for streetlights in Paris, aqueducts and cleaner air. He believed science education was imperative to the future. So he used his money to establish 2 schools, the Lycée Lavoisier and the Musée des Arts et Métiers. One might hope the benefits of having an Antoine Lavoisier might outweigh an urge to kill all of the taxmen. But poverty and taxation were among the driving forces behind the revolution. Lavoisier was among 28 people arrested for tax fraud on 24th of November, 1793. He was found guilty as charged on 8th of May, 1794, and sentenced to die. Lavoisier begged for clemency, but the judge was allegedly having none of it, stating, La révolution n'est pas besoin de savants. A revolution does not need scholars. The revolution didn't need stenographers either, apparently. We only have eyewitness accounts of the interaction. While coming to terms with his own mortality, legend has it Antoine Lavoisier devised one final experiment. Lavoisier wanted to know, once head and body were separated, how long would the head survive? The history is full of weird urban legends around decapitation. Eyewitnesses claim Mary Queen of Scots' lips kept moving for 15 minutes after the axe cleft her in two. Today we might question if the dying bursts of nerves and synapses couldn't create such ongoing movement. Others claim Sir Everard Digby, conspirator in the gunpowder plot to kill Mary's son, James I of England, continued to proclaim his innocence after his beheading. Of course, that's a very hard thing to do without lungs to power your voice, for one. When Charlotte Corday was guillotined in July 1793 for assassinating the radical journalist Jean-Paul Marais as he bathed, some in the crowd claimed she blushed with indignation. It should go without saying all of the above can be easily dismissed, as perhaps can the following tale, but I'm going to tell it regardless. On 8th of May, 1794, Antoine Lavoisier was led up to the killing machine. He kneeled under the blade and steeled himself for the blow. An assistant crouched down nearby. The blade fell, and the assistant counted.
Un, deux, trois, quatre, cinq, sept, huit, neuf, dix.
As he looked on intensely into the scientist's eyes. Now, I can't say if he counted Mississippi's in between, but I can say the assistant allegedly counted blinks. Legend has it Antoine Lavoisier set about blinking once a second till he couldn't anymore. Legend has it he blinked around 20 times before expiring. Cardiologists, thanks to science progressing a long way regardless of reigns of terror, can state a brain survives 4 seconds after decapitation if the victim was standing, up to 12 seconds if the victim is reclined. But scientists would also quickly state the blow should have knocked Lavoisier unconscious, making blinking impossible. France executed more than 17,000 people during the Reign of Terror. They used the guillotine as an execution method till September the 10th, 1977. Thank you for listening. This has been Tales of History and Imagination. All episodes written and narrated by me, Simone Whitlow. All music, yours truly. Visit the show at historyandimagination.com. You can follow me on social media, links in the show notes. Get access to exclusive bonus content via my Patreon, also in the notes. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a like on your podcatcher of choice and share the episode, as word of mouth is the best way to help shows like this grow. See you back in 2 weeks' time for more tales of history and imagination.